Kind of appropriate today now, being the 3rd of July, that we would be revolving around that period of time in the history of our country as the passage of the Declaration of Independence. Now, don't confuse the Declaration of Independence with the Constitution of the United States of America. The Declaration of Independence was one of the first steps taken to guarantee the independence of our nation. The Constitution was not placed in operation until after the Revolutionary War is completed and finished, and that occurs back on about 1783. And so in 1776, which is a number of years prior to that, there is no Constitution. All that there is the British rule over the United States of America. And God's people, for whatever reason, it was a religious rebellion, and the Bible framed the beginnings of that thing. And we've come through that now. You ought to have that in your mind. And we've spent, now I guess this is the end of 6 months that we've spent going from from the discovery of this continent by Columbus right on up to the Declaration of Independence. And I suppose now anyone who would want to refer to the history of this nation without referring to God, you would see what a fool they would be. After 6 months of seeing God in operation and God moving again and again and again to bring about what he desired to have, I believe, in this country. And I did not hold that view when I started, but I hold the view this morning that God, by an act of divine providence, saw to it that America was here. I believe that without any doubt in my mind, that had it not been for God and had it not been for his plan, there's no way this nation could ever have existed. And we've come through 6 months, hopefully, and shown you why. This morning, we're going to try to give you an idea of how the Revolutionary War went, names and places and things like that. And I don't know that it will all be intelligible to you, but it'll give you some idea of what basically our forefathers were up against. And we'll conclude that this morning. And then we're going to take a break for several weeks. The Sunday school classes that have been being taught for the last 6 months are at an end, and some of them joining us this morning. The rest of them probably be back with us next week. And for the next few weeks, we'll take a break from American history and give you a little breather. And then about the 1st of August, we'll start back in again, and we're going to go through the Constitution of this country, how it was ratified, what it says, and basically how it has been destroyed over the last 200 years. It is not the same Constitution today that it was when it was ratified. And basically, we'll go through in the last two-year period of time, the Bill of Rights, which were the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. Every one of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution have been overruled in a court of law in the United States. You no longer have the rights that you had placed in the Constitution. And we'll go through that. We'll show you those things as we go through. You say, why in the world are we going to teach this in church? Because they don't teach it in school, the government's not going to teach it, and nobody's going to take the time to sit down and read it. And God did tell his people to teach and maintain their heritage. And it's a sad thing in America when the clergy and the churches have to teach Americans their own history because nobody else will teach it to them. But we will if it comes to that. Now, we have proceeded in the Revolutionary War, which again was not basically a war, it's kind of like a Vietnam thing for a long period of time, in that there was not a declared war. The Americans, the colonists at least, consistently decided and wanted peace. They did not want to break away from mother country, so to speak. And again, you have to realize the implications that are involved in severing the relationship that America had with Britain. And that was one basically of a mother and child. The Great Britain brought its produce and brought its goods here and cared for the colonies. Most all of the trade and economy, it was carried on from America to Britain. Of course, Britain had set it up that way. But now to turn around and to sever that relationship meant basically, if you're not careful, to cut your own throat. Because of the various acts that had been passed by King George and the British Parliament, Americans had not been able to produce their own raw materials into usable products. And even hats. There was a Hat Act, which forbade Americans from turning their own linen materials into hats. So when you're talking about breaking off from Great Britain, you're talking about everything from hats to iron is going to be cut off. And Americans, being much like you and I are, nobody votes or nobody opts for inconvenience. And so it was a great time of turmoil in the colonies. They did not want England to continue to oppress them, but at the same time, they did not want a complete break. So the drive was to settle somewhere in the middle, where England would back away and basically allow the colonies to return to self-rule and self-government, but at the same time remain that umbrella or that shelter over the colonies that would protect them. And as the scenes began to unfold in 1775 and 1776, it becomes more and more obvious that that simply is not going to happen. When the American colonies, now working through what they call the Continental Congress, when they send basically gestures of peace to King George in England, they are rejected and they are met with rules of Parliament, which basically pushes the colonies further away. One was the Act of Rebellion, which for all practical points and purposes made the war a declared war. And King George, in essence, snubbed his nose at all the gestures of peace that the colonists had offered him, which, by the way, was probably the greatest thing that ever happened to our country, and forced us into a position that really we did not want to be in. And it all came to a head in July and June of 1776 when the delegates met, and met there in Philadelphia and began to discuss what their options were. And it was decided by a majority that the options, of course, were to proclaim independence. John Jay, who was one of the leaders there, Samuel Adams and some of those other fellows, early in June placed before the Congress the proposition that America should declare its independence and should act independently and freely from any English rule. And that was the gist of the debate that went on for a little over a month there. And finally, early in July, what was called the Declaration of Independence was voted on. It was not initially passed because the Continental Congress was limited in its ability to make decisions. Again, the United States was not as it is today. They were very strong colonies or states, if they were, could be called that at that point. And these independent several states, they were not united or affiliated with these other states like they are today. And no two states could tell another state what to do. As a matter of fact, no 11 states could tell two other states what to do. Those states were independent states. They governed themselves, and they met on a collective level only to regulate this war and to make decisions that they could all be confederated in. And the early declaration, I believe, was 10 or 11 votes to 2 or something along that line, which meant that the Continental Congress was stalemated. They could not make a decision unless the vote was unanimous. And so after a period of debate and sending off, I believe, to New Jersey to gain another delegate who brought word back that his group was going to vote indeed for the declaration, finally it passed, and it was signed, I believe, by just a couple of signers and carried back to the very several states. It was considered, they returned again, and it was signed by all of the delegates and became probably one of the greatest pieces of legislation that our country has any idea of today. Basically, it proclaimed that the governmental powers of England had no power to regulate the colonies or the affairs of the United States. And basically, in essence, pushed America to the place where she would never be able to reconcile with England now, because she had set her course towards independence. And basically, it helped because they burned the bridges behind them. As long as there had been a means to go back, there would have been division among the people. There would have been division among the colonies. There would have been division even in the ranks of the military. But now the die had been cast and there was no retreating, and there was nothing before them but to be defeated and captivated, or to win their cause and to proclaim independence. And so the battle went on. It's very interesting that on the 4th of July in 1776, the war seemingly had gone rather well for the colonists and the patriot cause. We talked about the Battle of Breed's Hill around Boston, and how that the patriots had inflicted, even though they had lost these battles, they had inflicted many, many, many times over the number of casualties that they had sustained on the British. And the British basically are losing, you know, 8 to 10 men for every soldier that the colonists are losing. So although they're losing, as far as the battles are concerned, they are inflicting great damage in the ranks of the British. Now, we talked about some of the advantages that the colonists had in their cause, and one of those was the unpopularity of war in England. England had been fighting wars and fighting wars and fighting wars from the very earliest times. They had fought, I believe, 7 or 8 times with the country of France in the last 40 or 50 years. And the English people, basically, they were tired of fighting a war. Not only that, but there was a lot of disagreement with the British cause in this war. As a matter of fact, many of the high-ranking British soldiers refused to fight. They refused to be involved. They even rejected the summons of the crown and chose not to fight in this war because they realized, as one of the parliamentarians said, that America was the last stronghold of liberty. And many of those parliamentarians stood before the British Parliament and told how that America reminded them of what England had once been, and how that the fight was the fight for freedom and not the fight of rebellion. And so there was a lot of disagreement in England. As a matter of fact, England could only muster around 50,000 soldiers to come and fight in this war, which seems like a large number to you and I, but it was less than a third or a fourth of what England should have been able to call up at an instant to come and bring down a rebellion. Much, much lower numbers than what had fought in the European campaigns and those that had fought even in the French and Indian War. They could not raise the manpower because of the disagreement. So King George went to the continent of Europe and sought to hire troops to help his cause. And even on the continent of Europe, he was met again and again and again with negative votes in his favor. Nobody would come and help him. Catherine the Great of Russia would not even answer his letter. And so he was frustrated again and again and again. Finally, he was able to hire around 30,000 Hessians, which were Germans. And we mentioned the fact Germans just like to fight. You know, they'll go anywhere, I guess, for a chance to fight. And he was able to hire 30,000 Hessians to fight with him and brought those to America. And while things appeared to be going good for the Americans, on July the 4th, about the same time that the Declaration of Independence became part of our nation's history, the British troops invaded New York. And their idea was that, of course, they wanted to make a landing somewhere, and their idea was if they could cut this nation in half, you divide and conquer, that's always been the adage, and New York was basically about right in the middle of where everything was going on. And their design was to divide and conquer the colonies before they even had a chance to get started. The British invaded with 30,000 troops under General Howe. And of course, if you know anything about Washington, New York, and I don't have a map here this morning, I was going to bring it. New York basically is made up of several islands. They're around the various channels and bays, and New York is the city of islands. You have Staten Island, you have Long Island, and across from Long Island then basically on the mainland is Manhattan, and all of those areas exist there. Well, the first attack comes at Staten Island. And the British basically began to attack the enemy. George Washington begins really what almost proved to be his undoing about the middle of the war, but at the end of the war and on down through history has become known as one of his strong points, and that was his ability to retreat. You wouldn't think that, you know, a fellow would be recognized for his ability to retreat, but George Washington had a great ability to retreat. He had learned that in the French and Indian War. The first 2 or 3 battles Washington ever fought in as a soldier, he was defeated terribly. and had to retreat each time under the French and Indian War. Well, he learned some things, and Washington, if he didn't know anything else, he knew how to retreat. And when the British began to storm ashore there and began to set up their strongholds, Washington seemed to know just how long to fight to inflict pain to your enemy and then to withdraw before your enemy got so furious that he launched out and swatted you like a bug from the air. And suffice it to say, 30,000 troops were more than a match for Washington's few 5,000 or 6,000 troops. Had the British swatted, as I said before, they would have knocked the cause of liberty out of the air before it ever got started. But Washington knew just how to hang in there and just how to inflict pain, and then before the enemy retaliated, he would withdraw. At one point, Cornwallis, and we'll talk about it in a few minutes, has Washington just about where he wanted him. And Washington had won a minor victory there, or what the British had considered a minor victory, and he was holed up in Princeton. And again, we're kind of running ahead of ourselves. We'll get to this in a minute. But when Cornwallis was told, "You've got Washington here, go get him," and Cornwallis said, "Well, I'll wait and attack in the morning or in a couple of mornings." And he said, "I've got him here." He said, "I don't have to worry. He's not going anywhere." And one of the sergeant of arms of Cornwallis said, "If you leave these people here overnight," he said, "by God's grace, they'll be gone in the morning. There'll not be a man left." And he was right, because Washington knew how to retreat. He knew how to get out of there. And so Washington withdraws from Staten Island and goes over to Long Island. And there on Long Island, at the far end of the island there, he sets up his defensive perimeter. And while he's there waiting on things to take place, he's there at basically what we call Brooklyn now. And he's outnumbered 20,000 to 8,000. And he's got the northern tip, or Brooklyn, which is the area of Long Island, north end of Long Island. And he divides his units into three basically positions. He's got a center and then a flank on either side. And when the British attacked the center, and I believe it's the right flank, collapse immediately. And they are forced to retreat. Basically, the only thing that holds is I believe it was the left flank, but one of the flanks holds. And all at once, Howe has got the American army completely surrounded. And he has his fleet down here in the bay, ready to bring them up the river. And as he brings them up the Hudson River, he will, in essence, put them behind the American forces with his army in front of them, and the Americans are cut off. But the British, basically, if you want to draw a line and say where they lost it, as far as the battle is concerned and as far as the human element is concerned, for certainly God superintends all of these things, but they just delay. And Howe decides not to press the attack. And five times the American forces try to break out of this surrounding, or the British forces, and five times they are repelled. 1,500 American colonists lose their lives trying to get out of this thing, but they remain pinned down. And they're waiting for the inevitable. They're waiting for the British fleet to sail up the river and to finish the surrounding, and the war is going to be over. But Howe decides to wait rather than press his advantage, rather than press the attack. He waits, and he waits another day. And finally, when he's ready to attack, there's rain and sleet in the air, and the wind's out of the northeast. And if you look at a map of New York and Long Island, you realize that wind and snow driving out of the northeast kept the British from putting their fleet in position. They couldn't get into position when they were ready. And Washington, in a frantic move, has his men round up as many boats as they can find, and beginning under the cover of darkness, realizing they have to do something, Washington and his men make way across the river and basically ferry the troops across into what is now Manhattan. And they take them across, and of course the British fleet is just about a mile or so down the river, and well within range had they desired to move upriver and blast those boats right out of the water. But for some reason the British don't hear them. And even later on in the night, as the evacuation continues, the winds calm, the sky clears, and the waters just lay down flat. But for some reason, Washington is able to keep those troops quiet as they bring them across the water. And even in the morning, when the sun comes up, there's not a cloud in the sky. And this is one of the amazing things of the war. There's not a cloud in the sky, and when the sun comes up, Washington, I believe, placed in his diary that they still had some 2,000 men yet to get off of the island, yet to get off the island. Now the sun's up, the British can see from everywhere, and it is logged in almost every diary that was kept by the soldiers that morning that as the sun came up, and just about the time it got up where everybody could see, there began to arise a fog out of the ground around both the British and the American encampments. Nowhere else. And you say, well, it's coincidence. It was such a coincidence that most of the Americans and the British noted it in their diary. That it just came up there. And it stayed. It, matter of fact, one fellow said it was so strong that he couldn't see another fellow less than 12 feet away from him. That's how thick the fog was. And the fog held until Washington got the last soldier off the island and got him over to the mainland. And when it was all said and done, Washington was able to move most of his remaining 8,000 people off of that island and bring them to... He knew how to retreat. Let's put it that way. The British pursue, but I mean, here again, they've got them in Manhattan, and rather than go on and go after them, they decide to wait. And their waiting again costs them because Washington has time to pull his forces together and to encourage them. And now they're a unit again. But at any rate, they retreat first to Staten Island, then to Long Island, then to Manhattan. Then they retreat across the Hudson. Then they retreat into New Jersey. They go across the Delaware and down into Pennsylvania. And each time, Washington stays just long enough to harass the British forces and then withdraws. And becomes a master at that thing. He knows just exactly what to do. But Howe's delays are the things that give Washington the advantage. Every time Washington is up against the wall, Howe, for some reason, delays. At one point, Washington's army is retreating around a mountain, and Howe's divisions are coming around another mountain. And the roads that they're on merge just on the other side of that mountain. And had Howe's forces continued, they would have decimated Washington's men. But Howe decides to stop at the home of a woman and her husband who had before entertained British colonels and generals, although she was a sympathizer with Washington and his cause. Howe stops off there, and this lady, knowing that Washington's trying to get away, fixes tea and all of that good British stuff, and Howe sits there for about 4 hours and enjoys her hospitality, and that's the only way Washington's forces got away. And that happens time and time and time and time again, where Howe, with a superior British force, could have decimated the colonists' armies, and God, through one means or another, just keeps him off to one side. It's kind of like, you know, the Lord giving the victory to Gideon with unbelievable odds against him. And it's like the man of God that went up into the mountain and showed the young man all the hosts of the Lord that were there to fight for Israel. That's similar to what happened in the history of the Revolution. But what did happen because of that, Washington's ability to retreat and retreat and retreat and retreat and retreat cost him. Because if you're a colonist, you're not in this thing to retreat. You want a victory. And yet Washington continually is retreating and retreating and retreating and retreating, and now he's backed all the way down across Pennsylvania or across New Jersey and across the Delaware into Pennsylvania, and basically he's been running ever since this thing got started. The Continental Congress now becomes occupied with some fellows who get a little envious of Washington, some fellows who think they can do a better job, and so there's much conflict in the Congress, and the statement is made that all he's doing is running. All he's doing is running. He is prolonging an inevitable defeat. So Washington, whether it was to save face or whether he decided it was time, I guess only the Lord can tell us that later on, decides on December the 26th, 1776, and again, that's from July till December. He hasn't made any attacks. He's just been running. And now he decides on December the 26th that it's time to make a stand. And so, how many of you have ever seen the big picture of Washington crossing the Delaware? Okay, you know, he was going one way or the other because he went across it several times. But Washington decides to attack, and he decides to do it on Christmas, which is December the 25th. And his reasoning behind it was this. The fellows over on the other side of the lake there, other side of the Delaware, were Hessian troops. And he knew something about Germans. Germans love to celebrate. And when Germans celebrate, they always celebrate with what? Booze. All right? The Germans love booze. And so Washington intentionally planned his attack for the early morning hours of December the 26th, which is the day after Christmas when all these Hessians are going to be bombed out of their mind. And just about headache time, Washington crosses the Delaware. It took, the battle basically was at Trenton. The battle lasted 45 minutes, and in 45 minutes, Washington's troops took 1,000 British prisoners, or 1,000 Hessian prisoners. And was one of the great victories for the Americans because of their ability there to surprise and to take as many prisoners as they did. Now, Cornwallis, who is there commanding the British forces, realizes he's just about to go home. He thought that the battle lines were pretty much fixed. And again, you have to understand something about early warfare is that, you know, they didn't have tanks and guided missiles and laser bombs and all that kind of stuff. And when the winter settled in, most of the fighting stopped because it was a struggle just to survive. And so for the most part, when the winter set in, when the dead of winter came, most of the activity ceased in a war, and they waited until spring. That's why you find a passage in your Bible that said it came to pass at the time when kings went forth to battle. Okay, there was a time. They didn't just fight any time. They knew that if they fought at times when the weather was against them, they'd lose more men to the weather than they would to the battle. And the same thing is true even at this stage in the development of America. You just don't fight in the dead of winter. You're too busy trying to find food and shelter and wood for heat and just basically trying to stay alive. But Washington attacks December the 26th. Cornwallis is already on his way back to England. His wife has been sick. He's going to take the winter off. And word gets to him that we've just been defeated at Trenton. And so Cornwallis turns, comes back to his forces, and they tell him that Washington once again has retreated now. They got all ready to come in there, and Washington has retreated, and he's retreated up to Princeton, which is just a few miles north, northwest of where Trenton is, and they say, go after him now. This is where Cornwallis says, I've got him where I want him, I'll wait, and I'll get him when I want him. His delay cost him. Because what Washington did is lit all the campfires there around where his forces were encamped, and had them all blazing brightly and looked as though all the lamps were lit in the places where they did have shelter. It looked like they were encamped there. And while all the lights and everything were burning, Washington took all the boats and retreated back across the Delaware. The next day when Cornwallis came storming in, he came storming into a bunch of burned out campfires with no colonists again. A great defeat to the morale of the British because they could not seemingly pin down Washington. He always was out of the way and retreating. And they said sometimes that for the majority of the battle, Washington was rarely over 2 miles away from the British forces. But they couldn't pin him down. I mean, he just kind of skirted them. He just kind of shadowed them as they moved along there. And sometimes they could even see one another. But they were always out of shot and out of range. And when they'd get set up and ready to go, Washington would be gone. And that's the way he just intimidated his foe. So Washington wins a victory, basically there at Trenton, and takes 1,000 prisoners, retreats to Princeton. Now, spring comes on, 1777. And when spring comes on, the British have designs on again. We said before, their aim was to take New York. The decision was that if they could take New York, they would divide the colonies. Upon dividing the colonies, they would only have to fight half of them at one time, and they would ensure their own victory. So in the spring of 1777, General Burgoyne, who is in command of the British forces in Montreal, they come up with a brilliant plan. You remember Fort Ticonderoga. Fort Ticonderoga was one of the forts that was, matter of fact, the first fort captured way back when the shots were fired at Lexington and Concord. And the fort had been taken without firing a shot by Nathan Hale and Nathan Hale. No, it was, who had the Green Mountain Boys? Ethan Allen, thank you. Some of you know more about history than I do. Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold had taken the fort at Ticonderoga. Now, I have to give you a map here today. If New York looks like basically a cake somebody dropped on end. It's kind of flat and it's all mushed on one side, you know, like that. And if you can get that in your mind, you know what we're talking about here. Well, right in that mush on this side, if you go due north, you'll go right up into Canada there across the lake. Fort Ticonderoga was up near the border there. And it was decided that Burgoyne's forces would head south from Montreal. He would come directly south from Montreal. Colonel St. Leger would come down the St. Lawrence Seaway, and he would, once he reached the Great Lakes there, he would come across. So you got a fellow coming south, one coming out of the west, and it was also decided that Colonel Howe would come north from New York City, and the three of those would converge on Fort Ticonderoga. And in essence, they would divide the state in half, or the colony in half, and bring about the victory that they wanted. And right from the very beginning, there were problems. Because as Colonel St. Leger comes down and starts across the Mohawk River, he runs into a bunch of wild German settlers. And these wild German settlers are all on the cause of freedom, and they harass him so bad he finally has to abandon his attempts to come from the west. And as Howe comes north up the Hudson River, headed for Fort Ticonderoga, he gets a brilliant idea. Why? Nobody knows. But Howe decides it would be more advantageous for him to go back to New York City, to get all of his men on ships, to sail south and cross around the Chesapeake Bay and invade Philadelphia. So Howe turns around and retreats, which leaves Burgoyne all by himself. Now, that doesn't mean a whole lot because Burgoyne has a very, very powerful force. Burgoyne takes, basically, Ticonderoga without much trouble. Burgoyne, as he begins to press, thinking all these fellows are coming to his rescue, he gets a little bit careless. Wouldn't you if you thought there was another two armies coming to link up with you? And all at once, he finds himself down at Saratoga, surrounded by American forces. The Battle of Saratoga becomes the turning point of the war and probably the most important victory in the Revolutionary War. It was at Saratoga, under the command of, Benedict Arnold and a fellow by the name of Gates, who had become a general for the colonists. Arnold and Gates surround the forces of Burgoyne. Burgoyne has to surrender, and 5,000 prisoners are taken by the colonists. Now, you figure the British forces probably were never more, and I may be underestimating a bit, but I would say they probably were never more than around 60,000. You can imagine what it would be to lose 5,000 in one battle. 5,000 soldiers gone in one battle. They're taken captive. It becomes one of the greatest defeats that America had placed upon the British to that point. And it becomes the turning point, becomes a rallying point, because the Americans now see that they can defeat superior forces. And they continue to press the cause. In the fall of 1777, now that was in the spring and the summer, in the fall of 1777, Howe, who has retreated down the Hudson River, got back on the boats at New York City, takes his troops down around the Chesapeake Bay, sails up in there, and marches across, and Howe takes Philadelphia. Now, it seems like there's one victory and then a defeat. This is a great defeat for the colonists. Why would it be a great defeat to lose Philadelphia? Because Philadelphia had been where your Congress had met. Philadelphia had been where the Liberty Bell had been sounded. Philadelphia was the place where this had all begun. And it is a great shame for the British to have taken Philadelphia. It is during that coming winter of 1777 when Washington has his men right outside of Valley Forge there, which is very near Philadelphia. His army is there, and while the British are sleeping in the private residences of people in Philadelphia, with the fireplaces and plenty to eat, Washington's troops literally are starving to death in Valley Forge. One of the saddest parts of the war was that winter at Valley Forge. It is said that of about 10,000 men that were there, probably less than a dozen had a complete uniform. And most of them had no shoes. Most of them, you've seen the pictures, wrap pieces of blankets around their feet in order to stay somewhat warm. And toward the end of the winter, there were literally men that had no clothing, no clothes at all. There were men standing watch naked in the snow because they had no clothing. And food was short and scarce. And the problem was, again, down in Congress. You know, if there's ever a problem, you can blame it on Congress. And the Congress was down there, and they get word that these fellows are up here starving. And so Congress, rather than try and secure food or blankets or clothing, they would print more money. Remember, the Congress had decided they could print the script. It's just like it is today. It hadn't changed. And Congress would print all this paper money and send it up there to Valley Forge. The only problem was, if you wanted to buy goods close at hand, you had to buy them in Philadelphia, which was where the British were. And the British paid in gold. So the colonists couldn't get anything. And literally froze to death there. They lost men to starvation. They lost men to frostbite and freezing to death out there. They spent the winter. It was a harsh winter. And it was one of the coldest winters they had known, with sub-freezing temperatures for weeks on end, and the snow that didn't melt, it remained there. And while it was one of the most treacherous times for the Americans, I guess there's a light in every dark spot, a fellow by the name of von Steuben came. Von Steuben was a German. And when von Steuben got to Valley Forge, he looked around and he saw a bunch of troops. A lot of them were just green troops, had never fought in a battle. They didn't know anything about fighting a war. And von Steuben sat down, and he was the first fellow to write a military manual on how to drill and how to do this and how to do that. And he began drilling these troops and began training these troops. And he wrote the manual on how to reload a musket. You remember, a musket's not quite like a firearm is today. You had to drop some powder in and then a ball and then some wadding or a ball and then tamp that down in with a rod and seat that thing. Then you had to make sure the flint was here, and you had to cock the hammer and squeeze the hammer, and then you went through the whole process again. And a number of times these fellows were, you know, they'd been guilty of leaving the ramrod in and firing the ramrod, and then the gun was no good. It would fire. You could shoot somebody with a ramrod, basically. But after that, the gun was no good. You didn't have a rod to tamp everything down inside the barrel. And so these green troops, von Steuben began to train them. And it is said that by the end of winter, von Steuben had trained these Valley Forge troops to such an extent that they could volley a round of fire every 15 seconds. And by that meant you could line 400 men up on the front line, and every 15 seconds there was a volley of fire from those 400 men. He taught them how to march. He taught them how to hold ranks. He had basically, in a time when morale would seemingly have fallen apart, built the morale. And it is said that Washington's army was built at Valley Forge. Because of their hardships, because of the things they endured, nearly every battle that was fought beyond this point, if the Valley Forge Regiment was there, they were put in first because they were seasoned troops. Not only that, but these men had paid such a price that when their enlistment was up, they weren't about to go home. These Valley Forge troops were in it for the duration. They were going to stay until the cause of freedom was over. So Washington's hardship there at Valley Forge turned out to be a great asset for him toward the end of the war. These Valley Forge troops became very much toughened. In the spring of 1778, again, you realize God has to be involved because of the sporadic actions of the British. And you say, well, you know, it was they had other things on their mind, they had other plans, but the British do some very stupid things. For instance, we said before that they had New York, basically. If those three armies had marched and met at Ticonderoga, where they decided they were going, if they had followed their plans, the war would have been over. But nope. Because of some, and realizing again, here's a country that's fought war after war after war after war after war. If anybody understands the art of winning wars, Britain understands it. The English know it. The English generals, the English officers, even the English soldiers are much, much, much superior to the colonist forces. But for some reason, time and time again, they make dumb mistakes. They get the Americans surrounded on Long Island, and they don't press the battle. They have the Americans there at Princeton, and they don't press the battle. They have the Americans in 8 or 9 places where they could easily have won, and they don't press the battle. And now, in the spring of 1778, when Washington's troops are almost frozen to death, and yes, they're out there, and they're crack troops now, but they're starving. And guess what happens? Clinton comes to replace Howe. This ought to give you some clues what's going to happen now. When Clinton comes on the scene, you can forget it. Clinton shows up as a replacement for Howe, and the first thing Clinton does is he decides, see, his mind's still back. He said, we need to take New York. And he's looking back there saying, if we had taken New York, this thing would have been over. So Clinton withdraws all of the troops from Philadelphia. And the colonists, Washington's troops, march back into Philadelphia without firing a shot. Because Clinton decides to go to New York. And, you know, he's always in the wrong place, I guess, at the right time or something like that. And basically, to be honest with you, for about the next 2 or 3 years, Washington and the British Army up in New York, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, around in there, they just stand each other off. There are no major battles fought for 2 to 3 years. No major battles fought. They fire a few shots here and a few shots there. There's a little battle at this city and then a little battle at that city, but not a great conflict. The war basically now is taking a turn in other places. You have in the Midwest, what we call here the Midwest now, which was basically the wild, wild, wild west at that time. You've got the British forts along. First of all, you've got a British fort here in Detroit, and you've got British forts all along down through here. You've got British forts at Fort Vincennes, which is over in Illinois, up and down the Mississippi River. And a fellow comes to the forefront by the name of George Rogers Clark. And George Rogers Clark, he earns his reputation basically as a guerrilla fighter. And George Rogers Clark attacks and defeats several British forts and outposts. And basically what he does is keeps the British from ever gaining strength here in the Midwest. Now, it was not necessarily important in the battle for independence as far as determining the winner. But what it did was when the war was over, the British could not even seek to maintain outposts in the West. They were willing to give up the whole thing. They didn't have the manpower to maintain them because Clark had just riddled them in the West. So when it came time to make a peace treaty, the British never even held out any hopes of holding on to any land, even the land that was in the wild, wild, wild West where the colonists didn't even want to settle. The British gave it all up because Clark had defeated them. Out on the high seas, you had fellows like John Paul Jones. And John Paul Jones, of course, name occupies the famous place in history. And you saw pictures, I think, on the little video that we showed several weeks ago of what the navy of the colonies looked like. Of course, the British had what was called the Man of War. I think some of them had as many as 25 or 40. 25, was it 40? They had 25 guns per side, and I'm talking big cannons. We're talking 16-inch ball. That could do a lot of damage, you know. And they had these huge man-of-war ships, and the colonists basically had what would be called a longboat. A longboat probably from here back about halfway perhaps down this aisle, maybe 20 feet, 25 feet, made out of wood with simple seats across it. And they would take and strap a cannon to the front of that thing. Wasn't even made. They'd just strap a cannon in there. And they'd row that thing out there. And every time they fired it, they had to row back 25 or 30 feet because it just shoot them back across the water. And they began to see some victories, and they began to sink some of these British man-of-war ships and send them to the bottom. They began building a little bit bigger fleet, and John Paul Jones, of course, is a fellow who sails right up there in the middle of the British fleet, goes to battle and gets to fighting, and literally has his ship blown out from underneath him. And the British commander who sees that his ship is inevitably going to sink, it's already beginning to list to one side because it's taking on water, he sends across a message and offers John Paul Jones the right of surrender and offers his men free passage from the ship, just ceasefire, and it's all over. And Jones, of course, sends back the famous words, "Sir, I have not yet begun to fight." And, of course, he hadn't, because when he did, he defeated the British and brought another great victory for the American side. So the battles, basically, are going on in other places. As Clinton retreats from Philadelphia, Washington attempts to cause him some problems. He attacks the rear end of the column as it's leaving Philadelphia and does great damage to him there and begins to get him a little bit upset. It's about this time when some events take place, and of course Nathan Hale, upon the invasion of New York and upon the invasion of Philadelphia, Nathan Hale is captured, and Nathan Hale is taken to the gallows by the British. And as he's hanged, he, again, you've got these immortal words that survive. Nathan Hale, you couldn't find one person in America anymore to say this, I doubt. But Nathan Hale, as he's about to be hanged, says, "I regret that I have but one life to give for my country." There was a spirit of patriotism there. And people say, well, they love the United States. Folks, there wasn't a United States. What these people loved was liberty. The United States was not what they were fighting for. They were fighting for liberty. And they were fighting for liberty, and Nathan Hale was more than willing to give up his life for the sake of his country and its involvement in a cause of liberty. You also have at this time a plot uncovered. A fellow who is captured, he's on his way down to a fort, an American fort, and he's picked up by a patrol, and as they search this fellow in the heel of his boot, they find some plans, and they also find a pass into a fort at West Point, and it's signed by Benedict Arnold. And when they find that, sentries that catch him and discover this information, they want to find out how in the world this guy was able to forge a pass by Benedict Arnold. They were not able to put two and two together, and so they head back down there. They're going to take this young man and turn him over to Benedict Arnold and let Benedict Arnold, of course, kill him and put him in prison. And on the way, they run into another fellow who becomes Washington's chief of intelligence, and this fellow begins to quiz them, and he does put two and two together. And, of course, Benedict Arnold is found guilty of treason in trying to turn over West Point, the fort at West Point, to the British. Arnold escapes and makes his way out of the country. He is not executed for his crimes, and it is said down through history that he regrets all the days of his life what he did. Arnold was responsible for winning one of the greatest victories in the Revolution for us. Arnold was one responsible for taking Fort Ticonderoga in the first place. Benedict Arnold could have been the name of a hero, but now you'll never hear anybody naming their children Benedict Arnold, not in this country anyway, because of the way that he was. It is said that when Arnold was dying in Britain, that he requested that they bury him in his American uniform. He saw his mistake and regretted his mistake and asked that he be buried in his American uniform. Whether they did that or not, I do not know, but I know that that was his request, to be buried in his American uniform. But the battle, again, is a skirmish battle. In 1778, in the fall, Cornwallis decides to attack South Carolina. And his idea is that if they can achieve a stronghold there, obviously New York now, there's too many skirmishes up through there, too many battles. And so the idea is, let's go down south here to the Carolinas, and let's attack here where some weaker forces are found, and let's build us up a place here. Winter's coming on. Let's get us some seaports where we can bring in goods and manpower and ammunition, and we'll be ready then to take this country by force. And Cornwallis leads his troops in through there, and those guys get marching up through there in the Smoky Mountains. They get all turned around. You look at a path of their march, and I mean, it looks like a mosquito around a light bulb. They don't know where in the world they are. And finally, a fellow by the name of Green comes down there and just whacks them. I mean, he just messes them up good. And Cornwallis is forced to surrender, or to retreat, and to back out of there. And, of course, again, that's in 1778, the end of 1778, beginning of 1779. Cornwallis has to retreat, has to back out of the Carolinas. When he does, he sails back north towards the Chesapeake Bay, and when he gets up through there, his troops are retreating, his armada's dropping him off up there, and when he gets there, Washington is waiting for him, and the Battle of Yorktown takes place. And for all practical points and purposes, the Battle of Yorktown is the decisive blow. It is at the Battle of Yorktown when the surrender has to take place. Cornwallis has to surrender his sword. And basically, as I said before, for all practical points and purposes here, 1781 now, this thing's all over with. And it ends basically, there are other skirmishes, and again, the reason is because when the battle ends right here, it takes sometimes months for the word to get to the other outposts. And there's still some fighting going on there. And even on out into the Midwest where Clark and his boys are, it takes sometimes as long as 6 months to get word out there. So the Peace Treaty of Paris is not signed until 1783. But the Peace Treaty of Paris officially ends the Revolutionary War, grants to the colonies their right of self-government, their independent status as an independent country, and basically England removes its presence north of the St. Lawrence Seaway and agrees to stay up in Canada, and everything else from the eastern coast all the way over to the Mississippi River becomes the land owned by the United States of America. Now, I've taken you on a real quick trip this morning through the Revolutionary War. And you ought to be able to trace it and play it back just at a moment's notice. You say, what's important about all this? Not much. It's just a bunch of men dying. That's all it was. It's a bunch of men dying, a bunch of men being shot, a bunch of men killing one another. And what's important about that? Not much, other than the fact that a couple of things. Number one, freedom was on the line. And number two, God was on our side. And that basically was all there was to it. They asked a Revolutionary War hero about 60 years after the end of the war. He was one of the few surviving Revolutionary War heroes, and they interviewed him, and they asked him, you know, about this, that, and the other thing, and, you know, why he had fought. And every time they'd ask him something, he'd say, no, that wasn't the reason we fought. And they asked, you know, about the taxes, and he said, well, the stamp tax never really affected me, and the tax on tea never affected me. And they said, well, what in the world were you fighting for? And he said, I was fighting for what pretty most every one of the other fellows I fought with was fighting for. And he said, Great Britain meant that we shouldn't be able to govern ourselves, and we meant that we should. And he said, that's what we were fighting for. And so the cause of freedom became a right to govern yourself. That freedom came about from sources. The basic source was in the Word of God. And as we've said before, if you look at the quotes of the framers of the Constitution, whether it be Washington, Adams, even Jefferson, who was not a Christian, you look at what some of those men said. They quoted the Bible seven times more frequently than they quoted any other source. Other than that, they quoted writings by John Locke and by Blackstone. And John Locke and Blackstone were individuals who dealt in these things that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. That was the theme. Locke's contention was this: man is the basic unit of government. Man is free of himself. He is the source of government. A man governs himself, and there is no law higher than that. God has given to man the right to govern himself. When man steps out of line with that, God has placed certain things in nature that will control man. As a matter of fact, if John Locke was present today, he'd tell you where AIDS came from. I read an article this week said, you know, it's the religious right that's accusing God of sending AIDS to scourge the homosexuals. That's what Locke would have said. Locke would have said, God gave you the right to govern yourself, and he placed certain laws in nature. When you step outside those bounds, those laws themselves will take care of you. And that man then, as the supreme agent of government, had consolidated himself or had confederated himself with other men, and they had given the authority to government to take care of some of their responsibilities. That's just the opposite of the worldview today. Government is here to control mankind. And if you don't believe that, there is nothing that Washington believes today that is one iota out of line with the Communist Manifesto written by Marx and Engels. And if you want to argue that, I got a copy of it in my office, and I can show you everything Marx and Engels said is in operation in the United States today. Starting with no private ownership of land. And if you think you own your house, don't pay taxes on it this year and you'll see who owns it. But John Locke's contention was man governs himself, and man can then consolidate or confederate himself with other men, and they form cities or towns. And when they do that, then they can place some authority in the hands of a law enforcement officer or of a government official who can alleviate them of some of their responsibilities. In essence, every man doesn't have to set up all night and watch his home, because they have given the right to kill the invader to the law enforcement officer. And that was Locke's contention. That's why you had strong state rights, and that's why there was an opposition to a federal government. Jefferson opposed the federal government. Jefferson was abstract opposition to a federal government. And as a matter of fact, he believed that when government came together under one central head, it would be the undoing of our nation. We'll read some of those quotes to you as we begin to look at the Constitution. But those things came from the writings of John Locke and Blackstone. Blackstone talked about the Creator giving man certain rights, and that was the right of self-government and self-determination. And when these fellows were preaching independence and fighting for independence, it was not, folks, the right to live where if you don't have a job, you can go collect welfare. That's not what they were fighting for. What these men were fighting for was the right to tell government, leave me alone, don't come on my property, stay away from me and my family, I'll make my own way, I'll grow my own food, I'll educate my own children, you come on my land, I'll shoot you, nobody has a right to tell me what to do. That's the independence they were talking about. We'd call that anarchy today. You know why it's anarchy? And you know why it wasn't anarchy then? There's only one fiber, and that is there was a morality that our forefathers had that kept it from being anarchy. You put that same thing down today, and that's exactly what you have. You have mass murder in the streets and anarchy. Why? No belief in God, no morality. Back in 1776, you could give that right to people not going to go out and shoot each other. They had some moral fiber. People not going to go out and steal. They had some moral fiber. And it could work there, and it can't work now. That's why Adam said our Constitution was made for a moral people. And he said without a moral people, it is worthless. And you've got in the Hall of Archives in Washington, D.C., a worthless piece of paper because the Constitution can't control this country. That's why we've gone from three capital crimes in 1776, three crimes you could be executed for, to over 3,000 crimes today you can be executed for. A fellow said one time, is it unusual we have to have 5,000 laws on the books to get people to live by 10 commandments?